Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey, Seattle sisters!
It's your virtual sisters, Bianca, aka BB.
Shade or Shade, whichever one floats your boat.
And your girl, Jenny from the pod. And welcome to another episode of She's in the Pod,
the safe space for millennial women,
where we meet bi-weekly to talk life, growth, and sisterhood.
Hey, guys!
Hey!
Welcome back
to a new episode of She's in a Pod.
Yes, ooh. The official countdown now. This is three before we... say goodbye.
Yes. After this, two more episodes.
Two episodes left.
Gosh, the countdown is crazy now.
It's on.
It is. Hope you guys enjoyed our last episode. That was like a more of a gisty, you know, catch up. But today we have a special guest.
We are joined by a very, very special person. Would you like to do introductions, Ngozi?
Fellow Igbo sister.
Oh, you know what? Yeah.
Every day I'm isolated. It's okay.
Igbo.
Every day.
Ngozi. Exactly. You have to pronounce it well.
Every day. It's
hi,
okay.
Everyone. I'm Ngozi.
Yes.
Academist, and I'm a mental health leadership expert,
amazing,
a qualified psychotherapist, social worker, and business strategist.
Wow. The list goes on.
Amazing.
Absolutely. And obviously, you said you're the founder of the Frontline Therapist as well, right? Yes. So we'll get into that later on. But just want to start from the beginning in terms of your journey and how you became a psychotherapist and social worker as well.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. What led you to go into that sort of field?
No, everyone has a special story. It was like, yeah, I could give a special story. But in a short summary, I would say that... I think quite logical. So I was talking to somebody before and saying, I thought I wanted to help people. So I thought, what are the routes to help people? You can be a teacher, you can be a doctor, you can be all of that. Mm. So when I crossed all the others out of the list, I was like, nah, I could be a youth worker, but youth worker get capped at a certain price. I was just let me do a social worker because it made a little bit more, there was a bit more expansive. And initially I wanted to work with young people. And then when I started, I was like, nah, I'm not working with no young people. The way they work with them, I'm not feeling
it.
The way they mental health. But then you look in hindsight and then you realise the certain things that affected you when you were younger. And
when you're
making decisions, you're not going, oh yeah, because of this reason.
Yeah.
It's just sometimes the circumstances you're put into it. And then psychotherapy was more of, I want to work deeper. I was really interested in the mind. And if I'd known when I was younger that being a doctor was not just being a surgeon, I probably would have been a psychiatrist.
Because
there's actually lots of different roles you can in medicine. Growing up, you just think cutting people. So I wasn't good at science anyway. So I was like, X that. So that wasn't going to happen. So I went into psychotherapy because I was really interested in my own mind, let alone other people's mind. And it made sense to do psychotherapy. And then that's kind of why I did that. And then in doing that, you look back and you realize, okay, it makes sense why I entered into a profession where it's about deeper thinking, because I've always been a bit of a deep thinker. I don't just take things at face value.
I always find it interesting, like people who work in the healthcare space or even mental health, so like myself as well, like what actually prompted you to go in there? And it's like, for me, so I'm an occupational therapist, right?
I'm an OT.
Do
you work in the community or on the wards?
I work in a hospital, psychiatric hospital, but I was working in the prison beforehand.
Okay. You work in forensics.
I'm a forensic, babe.
Okay.
But to be honest, before I even got into this space, I didn't know what an OT was. All I knew was doctor, nurse, maybe psychologist, and that was it. And for me, it wasn't... I mean, I was interested in like the mind, but I wasn't too interested. I was more interested in like how to solve problems. And I was, I liked the healthcare sciencey side of things, but I wasn't that smart. Like I failed psychology. I wasn't too great at biology, but I was great at sociology and just like putting things together. And that's how I found out about OT. And even getting into forensics, mental health, I didn't know about it until like they sent me to Broadmoor on placement.
Oh my God.
I know. That was my reaction initially.
That's a gangster placement to do, yeah. I've watched the documentary.
Oh,
really?
Oh, it's
another level. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I saw that and obviously like my view of it initially was like, oh my gosh, why are you sending me here? But just coming out of it and what I experienced from that also solidified like why I wanted to go into this field. So I always find it interesting, like different people's journeys into that. But you mentioned psychotherapy. What is, for those who don't know what psychotherapy is, because obviously there's different types of therapists out there, what is it exactly?
In layman's terms, psychotherapy is essentially a practice whereby, let me talk to the people that usually receive psychotherapy. So if you're thinking, oh, what is psychotherapy? Why should I have it? It's essentially I call it a kind of, for want of a better word, treatment that enables you to heal past, present and future.
Okay.
Because people always focus on the past, you know, unresolved issues. But some people feel that they haven't got much to resolve. So I say you can utilize it to help you deal with the present circumstances and future. So it's basically a mirror, because I think that we can't see our own blind spots. We need somebody else to provide that for us. So it's a mirror that enables you to see things you can't see and gives you a safe space to deal with that and confront that space. And that's what I would say psychotherapy is. It's essentially a treatment. It's a treatment to deal with difficulties that we might have. It doesn't have to be deep difficulties. It hasn't got to be like, oh my God, major traumas. It could just be like what we call an MOT check. I want to find out what's going on. Because we might know ourselves, but I personally don't think you can know yourself by just knowing yourself. You've got to know yourself once you've seen a mirror.
Yeah.
And then from that, I think you can learn how to know yourself. But some people are living this false ideology. They can just wake up one day and go, I think I know myself. Yeah. How? Who told you that?
Yeah.
You know, how you interpret yourself is by your limited purview. Because you can't see behind your own back. Some of us can't even cream our own back, let alone. You know what I mean?
That is very sweet. Yeah.
How do we know ourselves without having a mirror that shows us the good, the bad, and the ugly? And are we willing to confront each side of it and accept that those that are ugly, we can actually make beautiful, but we have to accept that first we have ugly parts of ourselves.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah.
That's
really good.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got the frontline therapist as well, which I heard about for a long time, but I didn't realize it was you that founded it.
Your Igbo sister.
So talk to us about how, you know, why you started it, and obviously, you know, who it's for and, you know, how people can sort of access that and things like that.
Yeah, no, Frontline Therapist is an affordable online counselling service for Black and Asian and mixed heritage individuals. Well, it's for everyone, but those are the primary people I created it for. Essentially, and you would know, a lot of us Black and Asian people in the system, we are overrepresented. It's like we are a minority in this country, but we are overrepresented for many reasons. But we are underrepresented when it comes to psychology within the NHS. So within CAMHS, what's the thing that they give? They give the free therapy that they give? Free therapy that they give in the NHS?
Talking.
CBD?
Yeah, no, but the free therapy, what do they call it again?
Not IAPT.
That's it. IAPT, yeah. We're underrepresented in IAPT, which is part of the mental health system, but we're overrepresented within the forensic system. So those that get locked up. Usually for criminal offences, but also have a mental health disorder, overrepresented in prisons and overrepresented in secondary services, generally speaking. But we're underrepresented in the more healing pathways. So what's going on there? And then psychotherapy can be quite expensive. You know, there was a time in the period, and it's still to a degree, that it was only accessed by wealthier populations. So not even all white people can access it. It would be middle class people. And even it was even a thing where only middle class people were training that, because it's still a very expensive profession to train in. You know, I became a psychotherapist tooth and measure, but I only was able to do that because fortunately I wasn't married and single. I was single at the time, living at home. So it's an inaccessible, unfortunately, treatment pathway for many people. And because majority of, I guess, the therapists are white, and of course, when you come from a cultural background that's already misunderstood, you're concerned that when you enter into a space where you're going to be your most vulnerable, it's not going to be understood. Yeah. So I created Frontline Therapists for that reason, to kind of bridge the gap between price, make it affordable, and bridge the gap between culture. So giving people, you know, a choice. If you want to have a person that looks like you, then you can ask for that. It doesn't always mean it's the best thing, because my therapist is white. I wanted a black therapist, but then I didn't connect with the black therapist. I connected with the white therapist. But some people need to feel that they are understood and have to explain certain terminologies.
100%.
You know what I mean? Certain things, certain cultural things, especially when you're constantly feeling that you have to over-explain to everybody else. So that's why I created it, really to bridge that gap and to help our community, because still, within this day and age, things ain't changing. And what's quite interesting, because I'm doing my doctorate, this has been how it's been for the last 25 years.
Yeah.
If you read publications in the 90s, you'll think you're reading 2023 right now.
Wow.
Oh my gosh. 20 years ago, there was a paper that said black men are 4 times more likely to be sectioned on the Mental Health Act. Black men are still 4 times more likely.
It's still the same thing.
It's still the same. Imagine reduced, hasn't even increased. It's still the exact same thing. And I know that because I section a lot of black men. Things aren't changing. I don't know if they're getting worse, but they're not changing. They're not progressively getting
shifting,
better.
Or they
get stuck.
The issue is
a lot of like performative things that make you think that things are changing from the outside.
Because I thought things were changing. I mean, from my ignorant, I guess, point of view, where I just felt like people are taking mental health a lot more seriously now. There's a lot more awareness. There are a lot more platforms that are encouraging, you know, people to speak, and, you know, like solutions. You know, there's different platforms.
In terms of who's in the system, I think that's the system itself has changed.
What will it take then? What do you think?
Overhaul the complete system.
Yeah.
But the thing is about the system, the mental health system, it's entrenched within the system of the NHS, which is failing anyway.
Yeah,
it's separated from the system itself,
right?
So we can focus on that, and you know, I can focus on that, but it's also part of a wider system that's failing that people overall, people of ethnic minority, poor people, anyone that is below a certain socioeconomic living is going to potentially be failed. It's kind of like you're lucky if you get a good experience at NHS. I'm grateful for it. It's better than some countries, it's better than us back home. However, I've heard too many people don't have great experiences and are looking to go, I'm looking to go private. Like I'm going to just, you know,
I've heard it's not that expensive actually. Like, but to do it in terms of, like, if you have a subscription, so it's actually a lot more worth it in the long run, because NHS is...
Yeah. But what I heard, I mean, it's so... Down. The system is so flawed that even if you go private, you're still, most of the time, having to come back to the NHS.
I've heard that.
Really?
Someone was telling me that they went private for some stuff and their experiences, they came back to NHS.
You might get ahead of the queue in terms of getting
they were basically saying that the treatment that they were getting and the service they were getting, once they got there, it wasn't that much different to the NHS. And it's like, okay, well, why am I paying for this? You know, so I've heard that a few times that people tried it and it's not. I think private healthcare used to kind of mean a lot more years ago. And I don't know if that's because it was guarded from us because we couldn't afford it. So it's like it was made this thing that was like we couldn't access. But now people are accessing it more. Maybe it's always been like that. It's just that they never wanted it. They wanted their own thing. I don't know. But yeah, I've heard that a few times. So it's like, okay, what's our options? What are the options going to be here?
You know? Create them ourselves.
Yeah.
So I think you said something about, you know, when we were talking about the system, about the performative,
right?
But it's not only just the performative aspects of companies and organizations saying they're going to make changes. I think it's us coming together. I think we infight too much.
I agree.
And we don't come together I'm not the type of person that thinks, I don't think we're going to come together, but I mean ideas and saying, let's create businesses and solutions. You know, other communities did not complain when the riots occurred.
Not at all.
About youth clubs shutting down because they have their own community centers.
Very true.
If a community, if an estate put £1 a week could actually do quite a lot of things, but we don't. We rely a lot on government. Our relationship with government, I think, is quite concerning. That it concerns me anyways.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm more of like, the system ain't changing, so let's create something else. Yeah. Like, I don't know how much more we can complain. If our grandparents were complaining in the 90s that the system ain't changing, it hasn't changed now. What we're going to wait for another 20 years?
Let's
begin to do something. So I think there's something that's we've been... what's the word? Disempower a black community, because it seems like when I look at, when I research the papers, the same arguments that were used then are the same now.
Same, yeah.
That the government ain't doing this, and it's like, whoa, that's kind of scary. Mm. That if in the 90s, essentially nearly 30 years ago, because I was born in 1991, 30 years ago, people are complaining the same things and things ain't changed. I think then that means it's not just saying they need to change, we need to change.
Yeah.
Because if they're not going to change, then who's got to change?
We have to change.
Absolutely. And do you feel like, because I'm also just thinking, I guess, from my experience and what I've seen, the decision makers, usually who are at the top, don't look like us or anything like that. And obviously, they're making decisions for people, black people or ethnic minority people who are in the system. Do you feel like not having representation up there can also have an impact on, you know, the care and the treatments and just 100%. The amount of people?
Just in health care in general. For my TED talk.
We're going to get to that.
That's
what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about how can we disrupt the absence of black women leaders at the top of corporate Britain, but that includes all institutions.
Mm.
And especially with yourself, and stuff that we can talk about off the podcast, but anyone listening, is becoming a non-executive director. And so you can do that. You can become, so you know, when you are, I don't know if you work at NHS, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you would see that it will have the executive directors, non-executive directors.
Yeah.
I think you should definitely consider that. So it won't be in your NHS trust.
And
non-executive directors, I would say NED for sure, is basically part of the decision-making in any company, organisation. Anyone heard of trustees?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's basically that, but paid in corporate sector and NHS. A lot of us don't know about that, but we need to be getting into those positions, because we essentially, if you're in a company, you actually then be put on company's house. You'll go on as a director on company's house.
Okay.
But you can be on Ned on the prison, different things. So obviously in public sector, you won't be on company's house. But essentially you affect decision making. So you're sitting with the chair, the CEO, and all the exec teams.
Yeah.
Right? So yes, that's what I mean. We need to see, we didn't know about it. I didn't know about it until months ago. I'm thinking, wait a minute, there's access to people making power that affect us, and we're not involved in that. Because the issue is that we're getting involved. We're writing after the decision has been made.
That's
we need to be involved prior in those decision making. Exactly. Right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of it to do with access to social capital and knowledge. We don't know about roles like this. Like, oh, I can do this. With your experience as an OT, you can work in another NHS trust at top level, making sure that trust is considering the lives of ethnic minorities, the lives of black women, especially when it comes to, you know, maternity, all of these different things, right? So just as that's a good plug to say, think about anyone listening, non-executive director, put that in Google, start researching and consider, maybe if you don't think, oh, I have enough experience, do a trustee role, which is free in a charity, become a school governor, a year or two, and then start applying, because it's the equivalent role, but it's just free in the other roles.
Yeah.
That is the governing experience you need to become a NED. But yes, to go back to your question, if you have no one that looks like you at the top, right? Majority of people are not pioneers, meaning that they don't carve a new way.
Mm.
Majority of people follow. There's nothing wrong with following. We follow and then become leaders, right? Mm. Very few people are pioneers, because not all pioneers are leaders.
Mm.
So most people need to see somebody to affirm that is a possibility for them to open, right?
Absolutely.
If you didn't know about this, for example, podcast studio, then you're not going to go to it. If it's not being promoted, that you can come here and do a podcast, you're not going to look for this podcast. It had to be open and available to you to say, oh, and that's what it means for representation. It means that, oh, there's a visible presence. That means that I can attain to that position one day.
Mm.
So if you see nobody as a CEO, then in your mind, you would assume it's not open to you.
Yeah.
You would assume that I don't think I can go there, because if there's nobody as a CEO, one, you have no access to know how did you even become that first and foremost? Because there's a way to become a CEO, right? Mm-hmm. You have certain experience, da, 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 da. So you just be looking at somebody going, how did they get to that position?
Exactly.
It's like a big secret. The same with the private sector. If things are closed off to you, don't see that. If you don't know any black person accessing certain things, you'd be like, how did you do that? It's that simple. If no one ever went to Timbuktu, you're not going to go to Timbuktu.
Yeah.
But I ain't going there. I ain't going there. I don't know why. If you don't go there, that's the same thing, the same kind of understanding. So representation is important because it enables us, those that are looking at the top, to say, wow, I could potentially go there, I can get into that position, and I can also make impact. And also, that is probably where you make the biggest impact in terms of strategic decision makings, although those at the bottom floor, the workforce, are the most important. They're doing the work. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah. So
but
true.
Unfortunately, they haven't got the power.
They're
so doing what they've been told to do.
So what would you say to people who like hear what you're saying, but from your experience think, well, maybe people have had those experiences, or they know people have had those experiences, but because I have had seen circumstances where there are people, I know people in these positions, but they almost feel as though they've been treated like the token person, like the token representative for whether it's somewhere in Asia or you know, a black, whatever it is. Like what advice would you give to people who just feel like, okay, is there even any point of trying that? Because even though I'm there, is it just to make them feel better? Are they going to really hear what I have to say and take that on?
If you were a token, then you were a token. So you need to fight to get at least one or two
your voice
that
heard.
Look like
you.
No, it might be something to get your voice heard. The idea of a token is the idea, because it came from an understanding that, so when there was a time that it was only men that were in the workforce and women came in, women were tokens, right? So what they found out in research is that when you have one woman on a board of something, for example, on a board of directors, she can't make effective change. She's only one person. But if you put two more free, it's called an attrition rate, then you're able to make a bit more change.
More impact.
Power in numbers.
Yes.
So if you're a token, then what you should first fight for is to get somebody else
more people
on.
Okay.
Because you need that support. It's very hard, one person fighting against 10 other people. Not that they're all constantly fighting, but if you're coming for different diversity of thought, different perspective, and you're the only person, and you're the only person thinking that way, they're going to be like, you're the only one.
Yeah.
You all agree with this way.
Yeah.
So the idea of a token is the fact that you need to increase your tokenism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then so you're no longer a token.
Yeah.
You're now just a small minority that now has a voice. You have a greater voice than numbers. So the issue with tokens is that tokens either like to be the token, right?
Yeah, there are some.
They're their space, or the company only wants one person to say that they're diverse.
Just that's it.
Exactly. Just that box off.
So you're kind of satisfied to be the one, and the company also satisfied to keep you as the one.
Yeah.
Right? So the first job of a person, if you're the first of anything in the position,
you need to make
sure you're no longer the first.
Yeah.
You now have second or third people. Mm. That now supports your voice. Mm. Also, at the same time, just to add though, is be the token person, make sure you don't get someone that is just like you, because there is no point.
Yes.
I won't want to have a black person just from Hackney, just like myself, because there is no diversity. Just because we look we're black doesn't mean that's diversity.
And that feeds into the stereotype that they may think about us.
So there would be research that's shown, for example, if you got a black man from Eton, and there's probably very few, but a black man from Eton, right? And you see him go, oh my God, he's in this amazing position. He probably thinks quite similar to another white man from Eton.
Yeah.
They come from the same cultural background.
Exactly.
So his race is different. So the whole point of diversity of thought as well isn't just racial, though that's part of it. It is also the way someone thinks.
100%.
Where they come from. So as a black woman, I come from, for example, we're Igbo. So we're quite similar. Are you Igbo?
I'm just Caribbean.
You're Caribbean.
Yeah.
So they were all black. There's another diversity there because she's from the Caribbean. Whereas we are not as diverse as we think we are.
Mm.
We're all Igbo.
Yeah.
So even though we're different, it's just the idea that there's no point having a whole team of people and you've got four black people. Where you're from? Oh, you're all from Nigeria.
Yeah.
Well, then how diverse is it really then? Because you're from the same cultural background.
And although it's not our job to teach them how diverse we are as a race, I think it gives a level playing field that, like, again, like you're saying, we don't think the same. I think it's it kind of shows them that there is how much diversity there really is within races, within even, you know, for example, me and Jennifer, we're both from South London. So there's things we're going to have in common. But at the same time, like, we've grown up in different, went to different schools. So there's the differences and the similarities. And I think the similarities is, like you were saying, is what we can use to kind of like add power to our voice.
Yes.
But the differences also show people that, okay, you know what, like, again, if we're talking about working on a specific project, and I don't know, that project is for people in Southwark, there's going to be different perspectives because, okay, I grew up in Southwark, but then Jen grew up in, I don't know, Hackney or a different borough. So I think that is such a great point and what you were saying, because I always just wondered, like, okay, how, when we get to the top, I don't always feel like the top is the prize because of how people may be treated, or because, like you were saying, tokenism. But I think, like you were saying, the power in numbers is so important. Like you were saying, if you're you said to me, hit me, because one thing my mum would always say to me is, like, if you're the first of anything, make sure you're not the last.
Yeah.
Like, she'd always say
that.
And, like, you always have to make, if you have to be that sacrificial person to endure the most pain and, like, you know, break certain chains and stuff like that so that other people can come and you're making it easier for them, yeah. then it has to be the case. But just make sure you're not the last one.
But I think our, yeah. our parents' generation failed us.
Oh, 100%.
They didn't pass the baton down well.
100%. I agree. Well, I agree.
Because
I agree.
They should be more changed from the 90s, but something went wrong with the buttermilk.
I agree.
Yeah. There's no way that I'm seeing statistics and it's the same.
Yeah.
What it's literally the same thing. Like the other day I was looking, I mean, and it caused such a, like an opera. And I remember I was reading it. It was about, you know, how black women are something around like depression. And that's stuff that we already know. I think, wait, let me see if I can get it up. So it was...
I think I saw a post.
So it says, yeah,
this.
According to a new study, signs of depression in black women are less obvious.
I saw that, yeah.
Right? Wow. And it had like...
But less obvious to who? That's the question.
And I read it and I was thinking... Well, yeah, duh. Like, this is not
obvious
new,
stuff, yeah.
You know? So why is it? It's like we keep regurgitating, repeating. Like,
there's nothing
different
new.
Things, yeah.
And let me say this as well, yeah. Black people, we need to go into other forms of profession. We need more research.
Yeah.
Sickle cell. 100%. So much,
yeah.
It's underfunded.
Yeah.
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 Right? Yeah, I don't want to say other things. Sickle cell is underfunded, right? So that's why for me, a lot of... Sometimes the black celebrities, they piss me off because I don't understand what's going on. Like I said to the, I said to my husband, when I make a lot of money, I'm going to invest in sickle cell. I don't have it, but his family have it. His sister has it, and but it's such a thing. That was one of the things we had to do when we first got together. We had to do a sickle cell test, just to get a test, mate. I had to basically say, yeah, I'm trying to get babies because the guy with my GP was like. Oh, why do you want to do sickle cell? I'm like, Nigerian?
It's not freely given. You have to have like a solid reason.
Yeah, and I just wonder,
is it because it's only affects black people? Uh-huh. So they just kind of push it to the, you know, low priority list.
Because we also don't prioritize it. That's just
that's
the
thing.
Well.
But then it's the knowledge is power. It's like, maybe only some years ago, I found out about the fact that the two spouses, if you get together to get tested for those things, like those are things a lot of people in the black community aren't even aware of. So they get together, they marry someone, they have children with someone, not knowing what they're carrying or if they're carrying anything. And it's that knowledge as well. So it's like you were saying, like passing on the baton. And I think one of those things is like the things that the knowledge that you've gained from experience, I think. There's an essence of our parents not passing down that knowledge
not,
to us.
Because
even if they didn't know, it's like, okay, do you know what? I didn't know this and this really affected us and it pained us. But now you should know.
Because we know in Nigeria, the first thing that they do when you're getting together, it's easy to go.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. But it's like...
See, the Caribbean thing, we didn't. That's not a thing for us.
No, but the thing I didn't know until I met the person.
Yes.
And the first thing I got to get tested.
Well, you should have known that.
Like, yeah, I should have told you. That's why I should have said it. Yeah. I should have told you.
Yeah. For me, it was just... So I have the sickle cell trait.
Okay.
And it was just a random blood... I don't know what I did the blood test for. And I remember the doctor just saying, oh... No, the doctor didn't say anything. I was just looking through the sheet and I saw... The sickle cell trait. I was like, what is that? What do you mean by that?
See,
and that's
curious,
when the doctor told
asked,
me. And I went back home. I said to my mom, hey, did you know that I have the sickle cell trait?
Yeah.
She's like, huh?
So she didn't know.
She didn't even know. And I had to keep asking family members, like, hello, who?
Who knows?
Who knows? Like, what's going on?
So
on my mom's
time.
Side, on my dad's side.
Wow.
Nobody knew. And it's like, again, the thing about like, knowledge and whether they know it or not, like just knowing to check for these stuff or telling me like, oh, actually, from a younger age, because I found out at a later age, go to the doctors, check your blood type so that I know what to do in the future if I want to have kids and, you know, whatever decision I want to make around that. But yeah, it was such a shock. And I'm sure like a lot of people have gone through that same thing where either they still don't know till this day or they've just randomly found out or maybe via social media, because I know there's certain platforms now who are talking about like sickle cell.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think knowledge is definitely important. And also in like mental health and, you know, mental health is obviously an umbrella for so many different conditions, but even the conditions that we come across, right, in our settings, like different psychosis and, you know, just the terminology like PD and even ASD, like autism spectrum disorder, like a lot of clients that I work with and their families, I have to really go back to basics with them in terms of this is what it is. Like they get a report, they speak to the consultant who most of the time isn't of the same background or, you know, color erases them. And then they sort of turn to me and they're like, well, what did he say? Can you please explain it again? And it's just heartbreaking that they don't even have the chance to be able to understand like what condition they have or their family members have.
But so I've seen some experiences where black as a race, black people, some people, but are actually scared where they know something's wrong, but they don't know how much they're going to be looked after. Like, and they're almost scared of, like, a friend of mine. So my mom used to be in her early years. She used to be a social worker. There was a story about my mom where she always, like, if she met someone, even if you're a baby, she immediately knew. Like, my nephew, at about 2 months, she said to my sister, you need to go get him tested for autism. Wow. And my sister was like, I'm not going. For about 3-4 years, she just refused. And in the end, she went and got him tested, and he was autistic. And, like, so she was very good at picking things up at a really early stage. And I remember one time she was telling me a story about how she did a visit, and she was telling a young lady that she should go and get her child tested for ADHD. And she was basically just saying that the young lady was saying how scared she was because she, as a black boy, she doesn't know if, like, the system's going to look after her son, like, if he's going to get the care that he needs. And it's like, okay, well, I'm going to be left with this diagnosis, not knowing the information I need, not knowing what I'm going to do. And so a lot of people are just, they know something's up, but they're just scared because they don't want to be, and it's like they don't want to face the amount of men that are committed under the Mental Health Act. Yeah. Some people know, but they're like, well, if I go.
It's a postcode. Lottery.
Yeah.
Haringey, for example, hasn't got an autistic service. So if you are in Haringey, you have autism. Hackney has.
Okay. So that's crazy.
It's very true. It's a postcode lottery. So depending on the area that you live, depending on the services and provision that are around, if you do get a diagnosis, if you do get a statement of learning disability, what support are you going to get?
Yeah.
What support are you going to get? And the reality is, in all of the different services, we are overrepresented.
Yeah.
Which is
in the
scary.
System,
We're underrepresented at leadership. We're underrepresented in the
wealth, decision making,
all of that stuff. Aspect but of in things. Anything that has a level of injustice, that is socioeconomic, we're overrepresented. We're overrepresented in the children and families.
Yeah.
In child protection. I can't say for sure if we're underrepresented in, I think we probably are in disabilities. That's what's interesting.
Yes.
We're underrepresented in disability, but when we do get a diagnosis, the level of support, that's the question.
Yeah. Right.
About the understanding. And I think it's because mental illness in this country, mental health in this country, was understood under the white gaze.
All of their
patients were white. Mm. So trying to understand what mental illness, mental health, what ASD, what ADHD, what all of these different conditions look like in black people, who they themselves are trying to understand it and come to terms with it. And there's not enough research being done on us. We're so anti a lot of things, just as people, because of what we've gone through. We don't get involved in research. So that means that there is a lack of understanding. For example, eating disorders, you will know, right?
Yeah.
When I do eating disorder training, they rarely have a black person shown on their thing because... So when you're being trained, I say, what about black people or black women or Asians? Like, it's true. They don't even know what to say.
It's so funny you say that. It's like a slightly different angle, but just me being pregnant and looking at Googling loads of things, like if I have this symptom or that symptom, all of the examples I see are for white people. Yeah, I don't go red. Yeah. I don't turn purple.
I don't.
So, like, sometimes I'm trying to match their description to what I think could be related to me. I'm just like, I just wish there were more kind of black people in this area so that we have our own examples to look at and relate to. So that just struck a chord.
But it goes back to
that.
What, you know, because you're saying about just us having to do it, you know, us having to create practices.
We need to create our own systems, be the researchers, be the non-executive director. I love that.
Yeah,
and I'm going to suggest that to my husband because he actually works in NHS as a matron. Yeah.
What? So he's already band 8 then.
So he needs to, like, I'm going to definitely suggest that to him.
Extra, it's a part-time role. So you do like 2 or 3 days a month.
We need more black, and he works in mental health too.
Yeah.
So
100%. Tell him about that because it doesn't stop him from his role and that enables him. So if he wanted to go even further in his actual role, but yeah, there's lots of people that are working full time and have just an extra few days and you get good,
that's
decent
great.
Money.
Yeah. No, that's amazing.
Yeah. The change needs to start with us. And once we know, we need to do something about it.
That's it.
I think it's the letting go of the fear. You know, it's even like, you know, the saying of, well, black people are scared to go to the doctors. Even just stuff like that in general of like, there's a fear there. But I think one thing that I'm learning with the fear is that it's not just about me, it's about generations after me.
Absolutely.
Like, and I think that's what it is, because when we are engulfed in that fear, we're just thinking about ourselves, like, how am I going to live, or what am I going to do? But it's okay, what are my children or so-called children or my nieces, my nephews, how are they going to suffer, or how are they going to live after this when I'm long gone?
Yeah.
Is this something they're going to still be suffering because I decided not to do anything about this? And I think that's that's something that I'm like, that. Key thing.
But I will say I do understand where that fear stems from.
100%. It's valid. It's
again valid. Just going back to the criminal justice system, a lot of the people that have gone through there, that, you know, once they end up in on the wings, on the cells, they end up, you know, having a crisis or whatever, and they get sent to us, right? And usually when I read the case reports, or, you know, any sort of clinical notes about them, especially if they're Black, there's barely anything to be found. I'm here sort of scrambling, trying to figure out, okay, if they've come to me for like a cognitive assessment, or or this person needs an ADL, or a query ADHD, query ASD, but then you've got some of like our white counterparts where I can go as far as back as primary school. But then for the Black population, I can't see anything. And I've worked with so many young, older, whatever age, Black men who clearly there is something there. But for whatever reason, this has been, you know, obviously because of how society is, they're told they're aggressive. Their crime is the one thing that they look at. They're not looking at other factors that might have contributed
how they got
to where they are at the moment, you know, like they're hearing voices. No, but this person did this, but yes, this person's mentally ill as well. So I understand why, like, mothers, friends, families would not want to.
I'm scared and I'm working with
I'm scared too.
I'm scared because I wouldn't put, I've put too many people in hospital that I myself wouldn't put myself
in
their places. So that I had no option, because you cannot be out on the street because you are very unwell. But it is scary. You know, when, part of the reason why I was probably depressed for even a long time, I never went to my GP. I could not. My GP was rude.
Wow.
He was rude. And that's why we don't have a discussion. We don't have to have it today, but something to be discussed. A lot of GPs are Asian. So it isn't because
they're
white.
That's a good point.
My old GP in Hackney State, Newington, his dad was so lovely. I remember the lollipops I used to get. Aww. But when his son took over, bruh.
Really?
All I can say, I would cry when I leave the GP. Wow. You know, one time, I remember going to my GP and he was like, he literally was like, "You used to get bullied, didn't it?" Like, he was reading off my kid. And the way he did that, I started to cry. And then one time, I used to get so scared, I used to go, make my mum go, as an adult, I used to say, "Mum, please come with me." And one time, we went, "Mum, shut up, let her speak." And I was like, "Oh, this is the reason." That is why I never went to the GP, because
that's
he just
awful.
Made. Yeah, I don't know if he knew he was that horrible.
Yeah,
he was absolutely went through that. That horrible. Is not... So it wasn't even like maybe it was a racial thing. I don't know, but it wasn't even like I was thinking race. I just didn't like my GP. I didn't have any experience. I remember one day before I left Hackney, calling, and they said, "Oh, do you want to see female GP?" I said, "What? I've got a choice."
Oh,
I said, "Can I catch the female, please?" And from that, I never saw him again. Never saw him again. And she was so lovely. She was a Chinese lady, and she was so lovely. And I was like, if I had you growing up, I would have gone to GP all the time.
That's it. And that makes all the difference. It makes all the difference. The people that are there.
Imagine on top of that, if he was racist towards me, right? And a lot of people have that. They have those type of experiences. So no wonder why we're like, "I ain't going to the GP for anything." And even though I've got a different GP, because of that experience, I am hesitant, because I feel like I've got to fight. I have to fight to get my to the sickle cell. I asked for a blood test, he said no. I haven't tried to do a blood test, but I wanted to check for anemia. When I went to Nigeria, I found out I'm borderline anemic. So even now, when I think, "Oh, someone says to go GP," I'm like, "I don't."
It's the fight.
You got to prove why you feel you need something.
That's why a lot of people say, "Oh, when you go there, make sure you exaggerate your symptoms. Make sure."
My mom used to tell me that all the time. I'd have just something little. She'd be like,
"Make sure you tell." Just to get anything, you've got to over exaggerate and make it seem 10 times worse than it is, just to get a decent level of treatment.
They've dehumanized us in every aspect of these systems. It's even like, you know, when we talk about women giving birth and how, you know, the women have to fight for pain meds or, you know, I think I saw a study one time about, you know, because obviously we know, you know, women in terms of Black women, how more likely they are, etc. But I think I saw a study one time about, you know, how Black women are treated when it comes to in maternity care and stuff like that. And it was just, it was all, the stats were horrible. Mm. They were absolutely awful. It's almost like they see us, and it's that whole strong Black woman narrative, which happens within the Black community. And I think that's, we've partially got to take responsibility for that as well. But I seeing how people treat us, especially as Black men and Black women, almost like we don't feel pain.
Yeah.
You know, we are prone to experiencing any mental, emotional, yeah, trauma, physical, we don't feel it.
And you know what's so interesting about that? There's research in America that a person was telling me that they found that not only the fact that we go through medicine and racism, but one of the factors that they start to consider that why Black women are more likely to die in childbirth isn't just the fact that our pain is not considered. It's because we're going through so much pain that level of trauma given birth ends up being the camel that breaks the camel's back. The thing that breaks the camel's back. Mm. So the additional, so the trauma of giving birth, because it is a trauma when you're giving birth, right? Because of the way the black woman has to survive and navigate life, all that trauma on top of that,
okay,
because that has not been dealt with,
yeah, it's that, okay,
that's the hot that. Yes. Point.
So, wow. if hypothetically, if you've been through some crazy things and had a very traumatic life, or been through some, you know, and you kind of, I guess, at some point held it together up until then, if that's an experience, if you go into that room and you are treated a certain way and you're dealing with a lot of trauma, on top of the fact that, you know, you're bringing life into the world, that can really be like almost the last strike for women.
Yeah. So it's an additional factor to consider. And that's why it's really important, Black women that are listening to this, is to get help now.
Yeah.
You're not waiting.
Yeah, don't wait until
to
yeah.
grow and yeah. grow and grow and grow and grow. Yeah. And I think you see in little kids, because growing up in the 90s, it's slightly different now, where I think some of our children are getting diagnosed too quickly.
Yes, yeah. I agree with that.
In the 90s, Black kids were never getting diagnosed with anything. I had Blaine had ADHD, but I was just considered a bad breed.
Yeah.
But I was just considered odd or weird. Yeah. When it was like, huh? My symptoms was just like this other white girl screaming up and down.
Yeah.
But we were never considered that. We were just considered bad. Mm. And when I think about all of the kids that were considered bad, definitely
bad
bruck,
just say
same.
Bad bruck. Yeah.
Same thing.
With a bad bruck. Yeah.
And it's so interesting how our vulnerabilities are seen as different. Yeah. And because of the way we're cultured, so for example, when I talk to a young Black guy and I'm assessing him, right? And I'm actually with Asian doctors, but I can be with a white doctor, another Asian doctor. And then we're assessing him and he's saying like, yeah, man, da-da-da-da. He's doing all the bad. Then we're having a conversation after, and obviously he's unwell.
Mm.
But I'm sitting there thinking, okay, you know, when I hear the word aggressive, right? And then, but at the same time, I'm also aware, have I over-identified because I'm used to that, is that not aggressive?
You can become immune to
some
aspects. Yeah.
So there's a part of me that's really trying to make sure when I'm hearing him, this to me is not aggressive, but this, like,
you have to be hyper aware of that. It's crazy.
I've got to be so hyper aware that I'm not just, I'm not numb to behavior that actually is aggressive because I'm over identified because he's a Black person. Yeah. But it's interesting how the same kind of movement and gesticulations can be seen by another culture as aggressive.
Yes.
And that's 100%. He's just talking 100%. That way.
Yeah.
But in certain extra movements, like, oh, no, that's when he'd be a bit aggressive.
The threshold is very different. Because I've seen white people who, I mean, throwing chairs and, I mean, I know it's a bit, but that is what happens when they're very unwell.
Mm.
And then the same thing could happen to a Black person, but the restraints, for example, are much quicker.
People,
in a second, the alarm's pressed, then it's like you've got so many officers or, you know, HCAs coming through. Wow. And it's just,
So I have a question for you mental health experts. How often do you see mental, emotional trauma and issues affect someone's physical being? Like in terms of, have you had experiences or seen experiences where someone's, not well mentally, and it's starting to maybe eventually they become unwell physically as well, like in terms of their body, just their overall physical health. Because I think it's really important for especially Black people to understand how trauma, how these things can affect us physically and actually make us physically sick. Like it's we don't connect the two because we, you know, a lot of things that we ignore because we can't see it or feel it.
Mm.
We don't know the things that happen in our body and the things that we're internalizing that could actually affect us physically. Because I've said to the girls before, like my mom passed away from cancer a few years ago, and I've said to my family, I genuinely believe that my mom's trauma, a lot of things she went through life, made her sick. It really did. Honestly, I believe that. So And, you know, again, she didn't grow up with the tools. She was, you know, as she got older again, you know, she did a lot of things. So she was a lot aware. She was in therapy and stuff. But that was later on in her life. So I just it's such a heavy on my heart because I really wish people took the care to look after themselves mentally more. To understand that, okay, both are important. But it could get to a point where, okay, this is starting to now affect your physical body. How often do you see things like that? Or can you explain how real that can be? Because I don't think a lot of people really get that. Yeah.
I mean, I mean, the first thing I sort of thought about was, and again, maybe this is from my, like, what OTs usually look out for, is like self-neglect.
Okay.
Right? Usually
yes.
It's the first
yes.
point, but it gets ignored usually. Yeah. Especially that person, you know, they're not eating well, not, you know, not enough fluids, they're not taking care of themselves, like self-care is just, you know, non-existent. And especially like when they, you know, sort of come in, when they're very unwell, you can already sort of see physically that this person's unwell. And sometimes they don't always have to be shouting, or they don't always have to be like, you know, outwardly, you know, showing all these symptoms of mental illness. Sometimes they can just be quiet. We've got a lot of people who are selectively mute, right?
Wow.
They can speak, obviously, but maybe because of some sort of trauma or whatever, they're not talking at all. So that can affect them functionally as well. And then of course, like the more physical health side of things, like high blood pressure and just the stress that they're internalizing and not being able to speak to anybody about it. We've got some people who have experienced like so many, like the trauma that they've experienced, I can't even like imagine it. Like when I read their case, or if they start opening up about it as well, and then just seeing the signs, like their body is just tired.
Yeah,
they're tired of fighting. Let alone mentally, like physically, they can't even get up or anything like that. So in that sense, I've definitely seen that, and that's where it's like it's not just about medication. It's not just about, you know, therapies and stuff. And that's where we come in terms of getting them to be able to take care of themselves again, because again, that sort of contributes to recovery, right? And it contributes to, you know, how we can get them well enough again. But yeah, I think physically there's so many other, you know, symptoms that people ignore.
Yeah. And people don't know about. It's the knowledge
as
well.
They don't know about it. And or they wait until, unfortunately, it gets to the point where it's detrimental.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it costs them their life sometimes.
Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, what about you?
Yeah, I would to add to that, just to contribute, would be, for example, a gut holds a lot of hormones and stuff.
Yes.
So a lot of irritable bowel syndrome, a lot of Crohn's disease, a lot of different kind of autoimmune diseases that occur, especially within the gut. A lot of my friends that have that say they definitely was their trauma. Maybe their anger, bitterness. So sometimes it's not in the extreme end. So talking about the other end, just generally people just having things like that from childhood, are not forgiving. They feel like, that's what's caused a lot of their issues. And I remember when I was doing my therapy journey, there was a woman who had, I think it was Crohn's disease, where you get lots of pain and stuff. Yeah. And she had her Crohn's disease, she was on steroids, lots of steroids. And she, through therapy, was able to go off steroids by forgiving her family.
Wow.
So, and you hear that a lot of people, so a lot of alternative medicine.
Yeah.
So, when you go to like natural paths and stuff like that, they'll begin to tell you like how, you know, because of this. And it also affects your posture.
Yes.
So, carrying pain, carrying trauma can affect, again, not just your mental, your physical. Yeah. So even if you're not mentally disordered,
exactly,
it can affect you in other ways. And I think a lot of Black people, we don't talk a lot about our pain in this depth. We talk about racism. That's probably the pain that we go to the easiest, the quickest to talk to. But we don't talk about how that then affects all parts of our bodies, because out of maybe 10 friends of mine, maybe 6-7 of them now, you know, has to be particular in food. We can't eat the way we used to eat. I can still eat to a degree. But even I can't drink milk anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just certain things I can't do anymore. I'm like, bro, what happened, man? Certain things. You know, you're eating that cheeseburger, and next minute you're like, I'm going to be in the toilet for the day. So
it's even the smaller things that people ignore. Like, you think it's just, oh, you're getting older, but sometimes it literally is the mind connected to,
so a lot of my friends are doing a lot of, not only just eating clean, but living clean in terms of
The healing, forgiveness.
That's affected the body. So one of my friends said she had a quiet anger,
And she thought that's also that's what made her have irritable bowel syndrome, because her anger was just in there. She didn't outwardly show anger.
Yeah, exactly.
She was seething with anger when things that couldn't happen, and she thought that's what's caused health issues.
And that's a responsibility that we have to take as individuals.
We do.
Because it's not, like you were saying, it's not people who are diagnosed or could show obvious like mental disorders or they've been diagnosed with that. It's literally just your everyday person that like you're dealing with things. Everyone has, you know, has dealt with some sort of unforgiveness or bitterness or upset or hurt. And it's just, those things, it's the everyday things that I think I'm like, I wish people knew how these things affect you.
Yeah.
And they can really show up in every aspect of your life, not just in terms of the way you talk or your relationships, but literally the way you sleep, you know, the way you eat, et cetera, is so important. And again, as Black people,
overeating, undereating.
Exactly. All of it. It's just, you know, all of it, the way, even the way you talk or articulate yourself sometimes, it's like, you know, I've always been a talker, but it got to a point a few years ago where I was in therapy and I was like, I like to overshare a lot. Why am I doing that? Like certain things, that is it something that I'm proving or I'm trying to like, what is it internally? So even the everyday things, it's not, you don't want to get to a point where you're overthinking everything you do, right? And that's the line you got to draw. This, you know, in this world where we're talking about mental health so much, I don't want to get to a point where we're driving ourselves crazy trying to diagnose ourselves with things. But I do think, you know, being more self-aware is so important, because our bodies are, we've only got one.
Yeah.
Honestly. We only have one.
Absolutely. Even like, I spoke to my mom the other day about like hoarding.
Yes.
Right? Oh gosh.
Why does she
see
hoarding?
That? Yeah.
She on my nerves.
It's that spirit of hoarding.
I think the reason why that came up is because I read something just randomly somewhere around how hoarding and mental health can be linked.
Oh,
in terms of
I know that's facts.
It's
facts.
Are hoarded.
It's facts. I didn't know that.
There's clients. I have clients. I had clients on my caseload that were hoarders.
Wow. It's facts.
A lot of us, I don't know how it is in the Caribbean, but a lot of Africans, they hoard.
Same. It's same.
To the point
it's
we
same.
Can't go into their house.
It's the same.
But because they are going to work, some of these people are social workers. Some of our
nurses
are nurses. You can't go to their
house. I know someone who's like a social worker and they work in housing and socials. And they are a hoarder. And the thing is, I was telling my sister about this person, and I was saying that it's funny because I used to get so frustrated at the fact that this person hoards so much. I was like, why? But then as I've spent more time with that person, it's almost like an extension of what's going on in the mind.
Yeah.
Because it feels like so much is going on once that they can't like streamline
it. They won't be under mental health services.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because they are somewhat functioning.
Yes. It's that function of,
yeah.
So many, I know right now, the listeners are like, oh my God, I got that article, that's my mom.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
They will only clear up when family's coming. So when family's coming, they put everything, that was me. That one room.
Or it's like, no, wait, so I'm going to send it to Nigeria.
And it's like, you had it for 10 years. Let's throw it away. My mom was the queen of throwing things away. Listen, if you had things, you didn't use it for a month or two, it's in the bin.
Yeah.
We used to get so frustrated at her. My brother would always shout at her. She didn't care. And I'm the same way. I can't have things. Like, my sister would be like, oh no, you might need that. And she's not a hoarder, but she might, you know, just in case, maybe keep it for like, no, it's going.
Let me just see.
It's okay. God will bless you with the resources. If I need it again, I'll buy it again. Okay. I'm not holding it.
You need a pastor. I'll be like, no, just wait for one more year.
Let's just see. It might come in use.
Please, get rid of it. The thing is, my mind, the way I like my space, my environment, my mind reflects that I cannot function if my environment is not in a certain like a space, or you know, in terms of how cleanly it is.
Yeah.
I can't, my mind just doesn't work. So I know what I need mentally, my capacity. I can't work in a space where there's too much stuff. I feel overwhelmed.
Really? I like organized mess. When everything is cleared, I don't know where things are.
I love storage. Even the storage has to be organized.
My husband, where is that thing?
My seasonings have labels. Everything. Like,
wow. Do you do things in alphabetical order?
I don't do alphabetical order, but like with my clothes, everything's in color.
Wow.
Everything's in color.
One day I will get there. It makes me feel so peaceful. I feel at peace when things are in.
When you're rushing, like, what do you do then when you're rushing?
Do you know what? So there are moments where I'm rushing, like, for example, I'm getting ready and I'm rushing in time wise. But like, I cannot, you know, some people just like, I'll go to bed and clean up in the morning. Before I go to bed, everything has to be gone and cleared.
Nah.
If you wash your plates after you eat,
So not straight away, but it has to be done at night. So yeah, it has to be done the wow. same night. But and if it's done in the morning, it's because maybe I've gotten home at like 3 a.m. yeah, like or whatever. Mom, like, yeah, but it has similar. To be done. I can't go to bed without washing the dishes. I can't. Wow. I can't leave them overnight. Good. I can't. Wow. I cannot. It's
my. Like, wow. I know.
I'm
even embarrassed.
The thing is, I tried those things. I've actually tried it, and there's been moments where I get in bed and I in my head I'm like, oh my god, it's not done. And I get up, and it's like 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning. I have to get up and just do it. So it bothers me. I sleep, even the way I sleep, I feel so much more peaceful and I feel more rested when the things are done. Yeah, I can't. The hoarding spirit. Mm-mm.
Wow.
I cannot. No. I cannot.
I'm literally in a fight right now trying to get my storage cleared out.
Really?
Just wish me luck.
Yeah, and I have a certain amount of patience as well. So if like, because I don't live alone, so I don't have like housemates and whatever. So like, they are very different. And when I tell you, the Lord has been working on my patience, because I've been like, you know, one of the someone that I live, they were redecorating the whole room, redoing it, drilling everything. And for about 3 weeks, there was just stuff in the hallway. I kept saying to my sister, I'm going to lose it. I'm going to lose it. I'm going to lose it. And I just have to. And one day I just said, okay, this needs to be cleared now. It needs to be cleared. And
how is it? Because you know, I don't know if you found that living with people can actually exacerbate people's mental health issues.
Listen, you're not wrong. Sis, you're not wrong.
All my clients were either the people terrorizing others or being terrorized by other people that they lived with.
Yeah, no, wow. Sis, you're not wrong. Because I live with my aunt, but right now she's in Ghana. She's been gone for a few months. And the two other people I live with, they're two boys in their 20s. Mm-hmm. Young, a couple of years younger. One's 27, maybe one's 25.
Are they related to you as well?
So they're related to the aunt that I live with. Yeah. And so during that process, this process, I've been like, yeah, there's been moments where I genuinely felt like in my body, I just feel overwhelmed. Because like, obviously, I'm learning to have, it's teaching me patience, because I can't always, like, for example, once I get married and stuff, my husband may be I can't always, it's not every battle, right? That's one thing I'm learning. Yeah, it's not every battle. Battles. Pick your battles. Yeah. Because it's not, because then they'll just be like, okay, you're saying the most and they're not actually listening to what I'm saying. But I have felt moments where I'm like, I don't know how much longer I can take this. Like, I feel like I almost, sometimes these days I just want to cry, because I'm just like, this is not it. Like, you know, somehow men are. So I'm only doing the cleaning. I'm doing just the certain ways they do things. So I've tried to communicate that in the best of my ability, in the most PC way. Obviously, sometimes that doesn't always happen because of my lack of patience. But there's moments where I do feel like my mind is going, it's just, I'm going, like I'm going to explode.
You share a bathroom with them.
I do. And that's, again, I'm the only one that cleans that. Like, If if things are not clean in the house, especially because my aunt's away, it's not, if I don't do it, it's not getting done. Nothing's getting done.
I've never shared before, apart from my husband.
Yeah. So like this year, it literally
is not for, uni taught me that sharing is not for the faint-hearted.
It's not.
Even with girls.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
not, you would think, oh, yeah. girls, no.
Girls' toilets are disgusting.
What, her? Huh? Yeah, they see are. Dry. Yeah. I'm not even going into detail.
Hair in the drain, all that kind of stuff.
I'm not even going to get into detail, it's not.
Because I'm the sort of person where as soon as I'm done with something, I clean that space.
You can clean other people's
space. You know what it is? I will try and leave it, sis, I've tried to leave it as long as possible. So that, but I cannot. There's a certain level it gets to where I'm like, I can't live like this. So I just have to do it. So this, honestly, last year when I came back from Ghana, because remember I was living in Ghana. When I was in Ghana last year, I was there for 5 months and I actually lived alone. That was my first time living alone. And when I came back, I said, oh my gosh, because it was a whole new world to me living alone. The fact that I had full control and anatomy over my space, my living. And so this year, I'm 100%, I want to live alone now. I know that's for me. But yeah, it's tested me to the point where I really feel like it's like, I feel tense. I feel tense. So it's not for everyone living with people.
And how much more when you actually are paranoid or you have other levels.
Exactly. Can you imagine?
Exactly.
Can you imagine? I deal with quite a bit of anxiety. And that feeds into things. Because sometimes, like, I can even say, oh, do you mind, your dishes has been there for 3 days? Do you mind washing? No, this is real. It's real. Can you mind washing? And like, I even feel anxiety.
Because I can imagine how annoying.
And I even feel anxiety sometimes being in the house, like, or saying things that I just, because I overthink everything. So it's like, okay, oh my God, are they going to make it hell for me now that I've asked them to do something? Like, it's difficult. So I can imagine someone who's actually like officially diagnosed with something, living with people who are total strangers to them, who they don't necessarily trust with themselves, being vulnerable. It must be extremely difficult. Yeah. It must be difficult.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. But I wish we had more time.
There's so much more to get into. This has been so insightful. I think my main takeaway is we've got to start with us. Like, we have to be the change.
100%.
From the knowledge that we have, let's do something about it.
Yeah.
Rather than just complaining, managing. Yeah. Let's start to move into those uncomfortable positions, having those difficult conversations, and just make a change from where we can start.
Yeah. And seeing ourselves in higher positions. I mean, I've heard about Ned as well, and also Claude Williams.
I don't know.
He's also great.
H and I think CNI.
Yes. Yeah. So he's also great.
Sorry, for those that don't know, what's CNI?
Oh, Camden Islington Mental Health Trust.
Okay.
NHS Trust, sorry.
So with Claude Williams, he sort of helps people who are wanting to get into that field as well as a NED. So he's also someone I'll be talking to again to try and get into that. But that's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Where can people find you?
People can find me in Ngozi, NGOZIGACADMUS. So Ngozi Cadmus, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter. LinkedIn, you can find.
I follow you, by the way, so I really enjoy your posts, like your podcast and stuff.
Thank you. Really good.
The sound is really good, very crisp.
Thank you. That's good.
Yes.
That's good to my husband. He's all
the tech guy. He's the tech guy.
Love it.
So he
like,
We love a good tech man.
And the Frontline Therapist as well.
Yeah, so frontlinetherapist.com.
Amazing.
Go into the Instagram people. It's usually easier, isn't it? And then you can go on. And then if you are seeking counseling, and if it's your, you know, first time, consider it and think about it. And then just email us. That's always good as well, to ask certain questions that you have, and then you can book yourself a consultation. Amazing. And after consultation, we can try and match you with a counsellor.
Amazing. I've been following you guys since like the pandemic.
Oh, really?
Sad times, yeah. And I have obviously when Jen told us that the email got sent, I was like, oh my gosh, because I've been following you guys for a while. A few of my friends use Frontline as well. So amazing work, honestly.
Thank God.
Yes, we're rooting for you and everything you do. And also your TED Talk, quickly.
Tell us about that.
So March the 5th, King's College. So there's some tickets available, but if you can't come to the show to watch it, it will come out in YouTube hopefully a month or thing. So you just got to make sure you share it with your friends, your family.
We're going to share it with our pages.
And also like people in leadership. That's what it's for.
Because you were telling us about the topic. Amazing.
So it's just important that we, particularly as Black women, begin to, if we want to, not for everybody, but if we're ambitious, to aim for the highest position, so we can affect change.
100%. Yes. And it's possible here, not just in America. Could you see those things, you know, women CEOs?
We can do it here.
It's possible. So
you know, it's just as bad as America. You know, there's only one Black CEO in a Fortune 500 company. So the equivalent to the FTSE 100.
There's just more over there. Yeah. America's more of everything.
But they do a lot of Black businesses. So yes. We definitely need to be in businesses. But we should also try and go into these blue chip companies as well, because those are the ones that are holding the economic power. Let's just be real.
Yeah.
You can do a bit to make money, create generational wealth. That is important. Yeah. But the Barclays Bank, all of these decision things makers, that have been doing for 20, 30 years, they affect the economy. So when we say, when we hear inflation,
cost of living,
and level create crisis, these are the companies that are all part of this process.
Yeah.
We need to be in there because they affect us.
Absolutely.
Love that.
Thank you so much.
This has been fantastic.
It's been an amazing episode. And all the best for your TED Talk. We'll post about it as well.
Thank you. 100%.
Guys, thank you so much for watching another episode or listening, watching whatever you do.
We haven't done visuals in a while, actually, so this is nice. I hope you enjoy seeing us on your screen.
Yes. Make sure you... Shani, what are you going to say? I'm going to say your line.
You like, share, follow... This episode, even you know, it deserves more than 5 stars. This has been a knowledge-packed episode full of 100%. Nuggets. So leave us a rating and review. Leave us a comment. Let us know your thoughts. And we just hope to hear from you guys soon. Feel free to reach out to Ngozi. She's giving you all, in fact, Ngozi.
She's
giving you all her details of how you can reach her on the Frontline Therapist. So yeah, reach out and keep supporting us, guys. We love and appreciate all your listens.
See you in 2 weeks, guys.
Bye. Bye.